The wages of skilled industrial workers in Germany could often keep pace with inflation, at least at first. Trade unions have been able to build upon employers' wartime concessions to secure improvements in pay and working hours. But for the unskilled, or those on fixed incomes or pensions, the inflation was a mounting disaster. In 1923, during the Ruhr crisis, it ran completely out of control and turned into an outright catastrophe. In 1914, the US dollar, by the end of the war the crucial hard currency in Germany, had been worth 4.20 marks. At the end of the war, it had climbed to 14 marks. By late 1920, it stood at 65 marks. In January 1922, it had reached 17,972 marks, and in November 1923, it had rocketed to a dizzy 44.2 billion marks. What such scarcely comprehensible figures meant to ordinary individuals living on their modest savings is graphically highlighted by the fate of an elderly, well-educated Berlin man, whose savings of 100,000 marks might in different times have provided for a reasonably comfortable retirement, but, with the currency worthless, was enough only to buy a ticket on the Underground Railway. He took a trip on the Underground around his city and, on returning, shut himself in his apartment, where he died of hunger. Nowhere in post-war Europe was there a land fit for heroes. Grieving widows, orphaned children, crippled soldiers mingled with the hungry, the unemployed and the destitute in towns and villages across the continent. The war had left around 8 million invalids in need of state support. In Germany alone, there were over 500,000 war widows and over 1 million orphans. Among the 650,000 who had suffered serious injury were 2,400 men blinded in the war, 65,000 who had lost either an arm or a leg, and over 1,300 who were now double amputees. Medicine had made advances during the war, but surgery could not fully heal such terrible wounds. And beyond the crippled bodies were the damaged minds, traumatized by war experiences, numbers estimated at 313,000 in Germany, 400,000 in Britain. Many never recovered, suffering from inadequate psychiatric treatment and scant public understanding of their condition. War invalids faced economic hardship and social discrimination. Employers didn't want physically handicapped workers, while former soldiers psychiatrically damaged by the war were often seen as hysterics or suspected of feigning illness to obtain a pension. The prominent British socialist and pacifist Ethel Snowden, whose husband Philip would become the first Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1924, vividly captured the social misery in Vienna just after the war. Uniformed officers sold roses in the cafes. Delicate women in faded finery begged with their children at street corners. Grass was growing in the principal streets. The shops were empty of consumers. At the labour exchanges, many thousands of men and women stood in long lines to receive their out-of-work pay. Gallant doctors struggled in clinic and hospital, with puny children covered with running sores, with practically no medicines, no soap, no disinfectants. In Eastern Europe, the situation was even more dire. Hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing from the Russian Civil War faced bleak prospects wherever they went, and seldom a friendly welcome from people themselves suffering great hardship. Poland, much of it ravaged for years by fighting, was in a terrible state. Half the population of Warsaw was receiving unemployment relief of some minimal kind just after the war. Disease was widespread, and in eastern Poland there was near starvation. The country reported Sir William Good, head of the British relief mission to Central and Eastern Europe in 1919, had undergone four or five occupations by different armies, each of which had combed the land for supplies. Most of the villages had been burnt down by the Russians in their retreat of 1915. Land had been uncultivated for 4 years. The population here was living upon roots, grass, acorns, and heather. The wonder is not that there were widespread political disturbances in much of post-war Europe, but that revolutionary upheavals weren't more extensive. Nearly everywhere, people had to contend not just with severe material hardship, but also with personal loss. In a people's war, with such immense casualties, there had to be some national recognition of the magnitude of the suffering. French families wanted their loved ones buried in the churchyards of their home villages. The government eventually yielded to public pressure, and the state paid for the exhumation and reburial of 300,000 of the identifiable dead. This was possible if a huge logistical and bureaucratic procedure, because the French dead had fallen mainly in their own country. For other nations, something similar was not feasible. The dead had to be commemorated where they had been killed, although victors and vanquished were kept separate. The French especially couldn't bear the thought of their loved ones lying alongside Germans. So where the German dead lay buried alongside the French and British, they were exhumed and reburied in separate cemeteries. The result was the establishment of war cemeteries, each country's uniform in somewhat different ways, on or near the former battlegrounds. The cemeteries symbolized immortal heroism and sacrifice for the nation. They also touched popular piety, evoking the sense that the sacrifice hadn't been in vain, and that the fallen would rise again in the presence of God. Among the serried white ranks of identical gravestones in the manicured lawns of the British cemeteries, would sometimes lie a soldier whose identity couldn't be established, accompanied by the simple inscription, "Known unto God." Bringing home an unknown soldier and interring him in a national shrine soon became the focal point of a nation's collective mourning. In 1920, amid enormous pomp and ritual, the French interred an unknown soldier beneath the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, the British in Westminster Abbey in London. Italy, Belgium, and Portugal followed these examples soon afterwards. What was possible in national commemoration for the fallen of the Western Front wasn't replicated in the East. No monument at all was erected in Russia. There, the war flowed without pause into the revolutionary struggles and the even greater losses of the horrific civil war. With Bolshevism's triumph, the First World War, viewed as simply a conflict of rapacious imperialist powers, receded behind the heroic myth of the civil war. Ideological demands meant that the First World War could have no place in collective memory. Nor could a feeling of national unity in memory of the fallen, similar to that of the victorious Western powers, be expected for the defeated countries, where the war had been divisive and led not just to military disaster and immense loss of life, but to huge political upheaval and ideological confrontation. Germany inaugurated a national monument to the dead in Berlin only as late as 1931, though many local war memorials preceded this. The meaning of the conflict and the German defeat were too bitterly contested to find unity in any war commemoration. At one end of the spectrum of public emotion lay grief, horror at the human cost of the war, and pacifism, so movingly captured in Käthe Kollwitz's sculpture, conceived during the war, completed more than a decade later, and placed in a Belgian cemetery of parents mourning the loss of their son. At the other end of the spectrum was a sense of national humiliation and anger at the defeat and accompanying revolution, which incorporated war heroism into hopes of national resurrection and rebirth. It was encapsulated in the Myth of Langemark. Near this Flemish village, with a German-sounding name, some 20,000 to 25,000 hastily assembled and badly trained young German volunteers had lost their lives in a futile battle with the British as early as autumn 1914. At the hands of German propaganda, this near-senseless loss had acquired lasting legendary status as a demonstration of the sacrifice and heroism of youth that was the necessary basis of national renewal. The myth of the fallen remained in Germany a central focus of ideological dispute that would find its disastrous resolution in the 1930s. The horror of the war made pacifists of many people. "The war itself had turned me into an opponent of war," was the reaction of the German socialist playwright Ernst Toller to what he described as a catastrophe for Europe, a plague on humanity, the crime of our century. From her revulsion at the death and suffering and despondency at the loss of her fiancé, her brother, and two close friends, the English writer Vera Brittain became a pacifist, socialist, and ardent fighter for women's rights. In France, Madeleine Vernet, who before the war had run an orphanage, founded the League of Women Against War, attracting support from feminists, socialists, and communists. There, as in many parts of Europe, ideals of peace and an end to the social inequalities built into capitalist competition found ready ears. Idealistic pacifism remained, however, confined to a minority. Most of the soldiers returning home weren't pacifists. They had fought, and would, if patriotic duty and necessity demanded it, reluctantly fight again. But they overwhelmingly wanted peace, security, a return to normality and a better future without war. The vast majority wanted to get back to their farms, their workplaces, their villages and towns, above all to their families. This was the most commonplace reaction, certainly in Western Europe, as people tried in different ways to reconstruct lives that had so often been upturned by the experience of this terrible conflict. The horror of what had happened produced the overwhelming conviction that there must never again be war. Champions of Counter-Revolution. Not all, however, felt that way. There was an altogether different and competing legacy of Europe's great conflagration, a legacy that glorified war and welcomed violence and hatred. For many, the war simply didn't end in November 1918. The culture shock of defeat, of revolution, and the triumph of socialism, and the paranoid fears of red terror in horror stories spread by refugees fleeing from the Russian Civil War, fed a brutal mentality in which the killing and maiming of those viewed as responsible for the disaster became a duty, necessity and pleasure, a normal way of life. New and frightening levels of intense political violence were a characteristic of much of post-war Europe. Northwestern Europe wasn't exempt, as testified by the high level of violence in Ireland between 1919 and 1923 during the struggle for independence from British rule, including sectarian killings, arbitrary brutality by British paramilitaries, the Black and Tans, and eventually a brief but bloody civil war in 1922 to 23. The short-lived Easter Rising against British rule in 1916 had been quickly suppressed, though it included counterproductive brutality towards prisoners and executions of the leaders of the insurrection that left an enduring legacy of bitterness. This fed into the guerrilla war for independence that from 1919 onwards was waged with much intimidatory violence by the Irish Republican Army, IRA. The British responded by deploying the Black and Tans, so called after their impoverished uniforms, part police dark green, not actually black, part army khaki. The black and tans comprised around 9,000 ex-servicemen, augmented by 2,200 former officers who formed an auxiliary division of the Royal Irish Constabulary, a force hated by Irish nationalists. The atrocities of the Black and Tans and Auxiliary Division, including rape, torture, murder, and the burning down of houses of supposed insurgents, went a long way towards poisoning Anglo-Irish relations for decades. Even Oswald Mosley, who more than a decade later would go on to lead the British Union of Fascists, was disgusted by their actions. Indeed, their violence was sickening, a lasting stain on British history. But Ireland was an exception in northwestern Europe, an exception even within the United Kingdom. The British government had always regarded Ireland as a quasi-colony, to be treated differently from other parts of the British Isles. Extremes of repressive violence were otherwise reserved for Britain's colonial possessions, such as the shooting by British troops under General Dyer of several hundred unarmed demonstrators in Amritsar in April 1919. As the struggle for Indian independence gathered support, inspired by Mahatma Gandhi. At home, on the British mainland, the scale of post-war disorder nowhere seriously threatened to turn into revolution. Civil defence formations were used in Britain and France to combat strikes in 1919 and 1920. But social and political unrest was contained by the state and fell far short of gathering any revolutionary momentum. Paramilitary mobilisation became a significant concern only a decade or so later in France, under different circumstances, and never threatened to upturn the political order in Britain. In southern Europe, it was a different matter. Mounting political violence formed a backdrop to the rise of fascism in Italy by 1922 and to the establishment of a military dictatorship in Spain the following year. And at the southeastern tip of Europe, the extreme violence that long predated the First World War and which had included the deportation and massacres of hundreds of thousands of Armenians in 1915 continued in the early post-war years. The worst occurred when, after 3 years under Greek occupation, the Turks retook the multi-ethnic Aegean port of Smyrna, now Izmir, on Turkey's western shores in September 1922, set fire to the parts of the city inhabited by Greeks and Armenians, and massacred tens of thousands of them. The endemic violence in the region finally subsided in 1923, with the end of catastrophic attempts by Greece to extend its territory to include western Turkey. The Treaty of Lausanne that year ratified an exchange of population, actually expulsions, the largest before the Second World War, with the establishment of the new Turkish Republic. It amounted to the first internationally agreed case of major ethnic cleansing, of over 1 million Greeks, most of whom had already fled from Anatolia the previous year, from Turkey, and 360,000 Turks from Greece. The epicentre of the new and extreme counter-revolutionary violence, greater than anything witnessed here since the Thirty Years' War of the 17th century, was located nevertheless in Central and Eastern Europe. Here, whole societies, not just soldiers returning from years of exposure to killing and inured to bloodshed and suffering, had been brutalized. Scorched earth policies and the deportation of civilians had been part of the war on the Eastern Front. And there the fighting didn't stop in November 1918, but flowed without break into fierce border conflicts in Poland and into the Russian Civil War of a horror that sent shockwaves convulsing throughout Eastern and Central Europe. Preventing Bolshevism from spreading to their own homelands was a crucial motive of counter-revolutionaries, some of whom readily participated in the anti-Bolshevik campaigns in the Baltic and elsewhere. But the violence wasn't simply a reaction to what was happening in Russia. The left-wing revolutions that swept the lands of the defeated Central Powers encountered opposition everywhere. Armed paramilitary organizations gathered strength amid the political chaos. Their leaders had invariably experienced the slaughter at the front, often in the east, during the First World War. What had horrified most Europeans had been, for these officers, an exhilarating experience. They heroized fighting and extolled killing. When they came home, it was to a world that they didn't understand, a world, as one put it, turned upside down. They felt a sense of betrayal, or simply saw no future in a return to mundane, often poverty-stricken civilian life. Many who felt this way found their way into the racial violence of paramilitary politics, burgeoning especially between the east of Germany and the west of Russia, and from the Baltic to the Balkans. The German Freikorps, freebooters at government expense, often under aristocratic leadership, are estimated to have attracted between 200,000 and 400,000 men. They operated where border conflicts, radical ethnic nationalism, the threat of Bolshevism, and a visceral hatred of Jews created a potent mix of violent emotions. Around a quarter of the 225,000 German officers returning home in 1918, mainly lower ranking from middle-class backgrounds, joined one or other of the paramilitary Freikorps units. So did a large number of unemployed former soldiers and landless labourers, hoping to acquire some land in the east and meanwhile contenting themselves with what they could plunder. War veterans were, however, outnumbered by activists too young to have fought in the war, though sharing a similar mentality with those disaffected by the peace. A war youth generation fed on militaristic values and expectations of national glory. The paramilitary recruits looked for ways to uphold, or try to recreate, the camaraderie, the trench community, the male bonds, and the sheer excitement of armed conflict. They recalled, or imagined, a sense of unity, of patriotic fervour, of commitment to a cause worth fighting and dying for. And this greatly magnified the bitterness they now felt towards those who, in their eyes, had demanded the enormous human sacrifice that had brought not victory and glory, but defeat and humiliation. It enormously heightened the thirst for revenge that these paramilitary recruits felt against those deemed responsible for loss of parts of their homeland, and those they viewed as creating a world opposed to all that they stood for. A world shaped by disorder, lack of authority, injustice, chaos, seen as fomented by the Reds, and effeminate democracy. Their response was extreme violence. The new upsurge of violence had no clear or coherent ideology. Greed, envy, thirst for material gain, desire to grab land, all played their part. The violence itself owed far more to untrammeled activism than to a preconceived view of a future society or the form of the state. But it was ideological just the same, targeted and not random, aimed at the revolutionary forces mainly perceived as internal enemies that threatened to destroy the values they held dear. Most prominent among these internal enemies were communists, socialists, and, not least, Jews. For many of the champions of counter-revolution, these internal enemies blended into one another. When they saw Jews playing a prominent part in revolutionary movements, Leon Trotsky, among others in Russia, Béla Kun in Hungary, Victor Adler and Otto Bauer in Austria, Kurt Eisner and Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, together with several leading figures in the short-lived Soviet Republic in Munich in April 1919. It just confirmed their fantasies, set in motion by that pre-war forgery of the Tsarist police, the protocols of the Elders of Zion, of a Jewish world conspiracy to undermine Europe's culture, morality, and political order. Jews had for the most part welcomed the Russian Revolution as heralding emancipation. They had great hopes of a socialist future without discrimination and persecution. They joined the revolutionary movement in disproportionate numbers and came to play a significant role in Soviet administration and policing. As many as 75% of the Kiev political police, the Cheka, in 1919 were Jewish, for instance. In Eastern Europe, Jews became identified with Bolshevism, though most were in fact not revolutionaries. They were to pay a terrible price. Many soldiers had soaked up the poisonous anti-Semitic propaganda that Central Powers and the Russians had spread in the trenches as adversity deepened and defeat became ever more likely. The chaotic conditions in Central and Eastern Europe that followed the end of the war saw a cascade of anti-Jewish violence. "Jews are hated everywhere," wrote a Russian sociologist in 1921. "They are hated by people regardless of their class or education, political persuasion, race or age." He saw hatred of the Jews as one of the most prominent features of Russian life today, perhaps even the most prominent. The Civil War led to an onslaught on Jews, at its worst in Ukraine. In some 1,300 pogroms there, between 50,000 and 60,000 Jews were killed. The continued fierce fighting between Ukrainians and Poles in East Galicia spawned anti-Jewish violence in over 100 townships, including Lvov, where 70 Jews were killed during a major pogrom when the Polish army entered the city in July 1919. There was extensive anti-Jewish violence too in Hungary after the collapse of Béla Kun's short-lived communist regime in August 1919. A flavour of the intense hatred of Jews and their identification with Bolshevism was captured by the remarks of an otherwise refined and charming Hungarian aristocratic lady, recalled by Ethel Snowden in summer 1919. "I would kill every Bolshevik if I could have my way, and they wouldn't die an easy death either. I would roast them in front of a slow fire. Think of what those dirty Jews have done to some of our best men, and all my clothes and jewels gone. Some horrid little Jewess is pulling my beautiful white boots onto her ugly feet this very minute, I'm positive." Given such a mentality, atrocities towards Jews in the wake of Hungary's post-war political turmoil were hardly surprising. In the parts of the country west of the Danube, more than 3,000 Jews were murdered, according to a report in 1922. Even in the new Czech Republic, a beacon of emerging democratic freedom among the new states to emerge from the Habsburg Empire, there were pogroms, while student riots forced the Jewish rector of Prague University to resign in 1922. Germany and Austria experienced no pogroms. The violent anti-Semitic rhetoric did its work nevertheless in poisoning the atmosphere that led to the murder of Jews in prominent political positions, such as Kurt Eisner, the Bavarian minister-president in 1919, and Walter Rathenau, the Reich foreign minister, in 1922. The violence of the counter-revolutionaries knew few bounds. It invariably went far beyond the revolutionary violence that they claimed to be combating. Red Terror is estimated to have taken the lives of 5 persons in Austria, up to 200 in Germany, and between 400 and 500 in Hungary. There were at least 850 victims of counter-revolutionary violence in Austria. The suppression of the Bavarian Soviet Republic at the end of April 1919 brought a death toll of 606 persons, 335 of them civilians. And White Terror in Hungary following the collapse of Béla Kun's Soviet regime in Budapest, killed around 1,500 people, at least three times the number who had died at the hands of the Reds. "No pardon is given. We shoot even the wounded," wrote one student volunteer to his parents after participating in the repression of a communist uprising in Germany's Ruhr district in 1920. "We slaughtered whoever fell into our hands. There were no human feelings left in our hearts," recalled another young German who participated in paramilitary fighting in the Baltic in 1919. Rudolf Höss, who later as commandant of Auschwitz presided over an unprecedented program of orchestrated mass killing, remembered the fighting in the Baltic as more grim than anything he had witnessed during the First World War. Pure slaughter to the point of complete annihilation. The Baltic and Upper Silesia, while there was fierce fighting between Poles and Germans between 1919 and 1921, were the settings for a huge loss of life, perhaps as high as 100,000 at the hands of paramilitaries. Paramilitary violence declined sharply after 1923, but those who had been at the forefront of the violence didn't alter in character or attitude, even if they had to adapt to changed times. Many would find new opportunities in the fascist movements that gathered support across Europe during the 1930s. And in the regions of greatest violence, there would be far worse to come, in no small measure as a reaction to the successful establishment of Soviet communism in Russia. Bolshevism triumphant. It was inevitable that the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 wouldn't be accepted without a fight by those who stood to be dispossessed of land and other property. The result was a civil war of unimaginable savagery and bloodshed that raged for 3 years and cost the lives of over 7 million men, women, and children, around four times Russia's losses in the Great War, the majority of them civilians. Huge numbers died from associated hunger and epidemic disease, as well as actual fighting and terroristic repression. What constituted the civil war was actually a series of wars, loosely interconnected through the common aim of the white counter-revolutionary forces to try to strangle the new Soviet regime at birth. There was an international dimension. The whites, led in the main by former high-ranking Tsarist officers and Cossacks, were backed by Allied troops, weaponry, and logistical support. Some 30,000 Czech, American, British, Italian, and French troops helped the White Army fighting westwards from Siberia in 1919. The Allies provided munitions for the whites equivalent to the entire Soviet production that year. Foreign support waned thereafter, however, and was of less importance than Soviet accounts of the Civil War later claimed. For a time, especially in 1919, the outcome was far from certain. But by late 1920, Bolshevik power over practically the entirety of the vast territory of the former Russian Empire had survived. The final stages of the Civil War merged with the war in 1920 of the increasingly victorious Red Army against Marshal Józef Piłsudski's Polish army. After the Poles had been driven out of Kiev, which changed hands a dozen times during the Civil War, and the Red Army had been repulsed in August by Piłsudski's forces at the gates of Warsaw, an armistice in the autumn of 1920 produced a settlement that extended the Polish eastern border with the Soviet state. The Treaty of Riga in March 1921 guaranteed the new border, at least until the next Great War. The anti-Soviet campaigns, reaching their climax in 1919, took place largely in the peripheral regions of the former Russian Empire. The key to ultimate victory by the Reds, however, was their control of the large central core zone of Russia, together with superior organizational capacity and utter ruthlessness as well as divisions among their opponents. The vast territory gave the Reds access to huge manpower reserves, conscripted with the help of a good dose of terror in the countryside, and foodstuffs, ruthlessly extracted from an increasingly truculent but brutally cowed peasantry. This made possible the rapid expansion of the Red Army, which grew from a mere 430,000 men in October 1918 to 5,300,000 by the end of 1920. Badly equipped, ill-provisioned, and often undisciplined though it was, the huge mass army, commanded by 75,000 former officers of the Tsarist army, marshalled by ferocious discipline and fighting to defend the revolution, was more than a match for the numerically weaker and less cohesive white forces. Although the popularity of the Soviet state, which had been built heavily upon promise of land reform for the overwhelmingly peasant population, was rapidly declining, Bolshevik supremacy, the suppression of opposition parties, and ruthless terror against any who offered resistance meant that there was little alternative to compliance. In any case, the whites put forward little by way of a social program that could favorably compete with that of the Bolsheviks. The white leaders, conservative Russian nationalists, whose only objective seemed to be to turn the clock back to the pre-revolutionary period, were unable to win much support from non-Russian nationalists in peripheral regions. Ukraine, for instance, had a population of some 32 million, largely peasant, fervent Ukrainian nationalists who couldn't be mobilized for the greater Russian cause. The whites lacked not just a coherent program, they were also organizationally weaker than the Soviets, could raise only smaller armies, suffered from poor communications, and had no coordinated military strategy. Yet, the outcome of the Civil War was far from a foregone conclusion. It took 3 years of the most bitter and bloody conflict before the Red Army was assured of outright victory. It would, nevertheless, have been against all the odds had Bolshevism not ultimately prevailed. When the Civil War ended, the Soviet economy was in ruins. Industrial production had fallen by over 66% compared with 1913, agricultural production by 40%. Politically, too, the problems were enormous. By early 1921, under the extreme food shortages caused by peasants holding back their produce, industrial workers in Russia's big cities, the heartlands of Bolshevism, were in revolt against the coercive methods of the regime. Martial law had to be declared in Moscow and St. Petersburg in the wake of huge strikes in February, new Russian calendar. Mounting danger for the regime reached a critical point in a rising by sailors, avid Bolshevik adherents in 1917, from the naval base in Kronstadt, just outside Petrograd, in March 1921. The regime reacted with utter ruthlessness. Trotsky warned the rebel sailors that they would be shot like partridges if they didn't surrender within 24 hours. When they continued to resist, Trotsky was as good as his word. A major assault on the fortress at Kronstadt was launched by 50,000 troops from the Red Army. After a battle lasting 18 hours, the uprising collapsed. Over 10,000 rebel sailors and Red Army soldiers lay dead. Thousands more rebels were executed or sent to concentration camps. The uprising of one-time ardent supporters has shocked the Bolshevik rulers to the core. If that was a warning, the regime faced a much bigger challenge in winning over the vast majority of the population, the peasantry, whose hostility to Bolshevik land policy had become acute. Immediately following the revolution, in order to win peasant support, the Bolsheviks had legalized the redistribution of land among the peasantry. But the forced requisitioning of peasant produce during the Civil War and early attempts to introduce farming collectives had created a rebellious peasantry. The collectives were unproductive. The peasants deliberately sowed less, Sometimes the forced extractions of grain, in any case, amounted to no seed left to sow. The result was famine in 1921-22. Peasant revolts broke out in numerous regions, sometimes accompanied by gruesome violence against local Bolsheviks. Lenin saw the threat to the regime from the peasant wars as greater than that of the whites in the Civil War. The response was a massive use of force to put down the peasant risings during the summer of 1921. Thousands of peasants were shot, tens of thousands more sent to camps. But the big stick was not enough. Coercion alone, as the Civil War has shown, wouldn't produce food. The Bolsheviks hadn't only completely alienated the major section of the population on whose cooperation they depended politically, they desperately needed the peasants to produce more. This brought a volte-face by the regime's leadership. Lenin bought off an increasingly rebellious peasantry by a new economic policy introduced at the 10th Party Congress in March 1921. This relaxed party control over agriculture and re-established a partial market economy while retaining state ownership of all major branches of industrial production, transport, energy, and communications. Goods started to appear again. Economic recovery was soon underway, even if there was great resentment in the towns at the profiteers who shamelessly exploited the new conditions of supply and demand. By the time of Lenin's death in January 1924, the economy had revived. The regime had weathered the major storm. Despite the buffeting it had taken, all parts of the Soviet state were by now in the hands of the Bolshevik Party. The party's organization, rigidly controlled from the center by its general secretary, Joseph Stalin, created a system of patronage and corruption that bought to the allegiance of growing numbers of placemen and apparatchiks. The number of bureaucrats quadrupled to 2.4 million within 4 years of the revolution, and a huge influx of new party members, almost 1.5 million entrants by 1920, two-thirds of them from peasant backgrounds, hoping for better lives, helped the Bolsheviks to consolidate their hold on power and to extend their penetration of the countryside. Early idealistic notions of popular participation in the running of political, economic, and social matters through elective representatives in the Soviets, based upon worker control of production, had of necessity been reformulated. Communism itself would have to wait till the dawn of the utopia. Meanwhile, power in the socialist state would and could only be exercised by the avant-garde of the proletariat, the party. Any opposition could be dubbed bourgeois and reactionary, and had to be destroyed. Bourgeois law couldn't stand in the way of the merciless extirpation of class enemies. Terror, as an essential weapon in the class war, was central to the Bolshevik revolutionary project. Let there be floods of bourgeois blood, more blood as much as possible, the Bolshevik press had urged in 1918. We must encourage the energy and the popular nature of the terror, Lenin had written that summer. Turning the hatred of peasants desperate for land against kulaks, portrayed as land exploiters but often only marginally better off peasants, was part of the strategy. Describing them as bloodsuckers who have grown rich on the hunger of the people, Lenin decried the kulaks as rabid foes of the Soviet government, leeches who have sucked the blood of the working people, and advocated death to all of them. By 1922, when the regime felt strong enough to attack religious worship and to destroy the hold of the Orthodox Church, Lenin encouraged merciless war against the clergy. The more members of the reactionary bourgeoisie and clergy we managed to shoot, the better, he stated. The early Soviet Union was already a regime in which conventional law had no place, one that gave license to the unconstrained power of the Cheka, the state security police. The Cheka must defend the revolution and conquer the enemy, even if its sword falls occasionally on the heads of the innocent, declared its head, Felix Dzerzhinsky. This was a cynical understatement. Arbitrary imprisonment, torture, and executions became commonplace. How many fell victim to the terror of the Cheka is not known. Estimates put the figure at several hundred thousand, including those thrown into prisons and camps. Inside the prisons, the torture methods deployed were hideous in the extreme. The essential characteristics of Bolshevik rule had then emerged during Lenin's lifetime. What followed was continuation and logical consequence, not an aberration. Within the Bolshevik leadership, intense political, ideological, and personal conflicts had been just about held in check as long as Lenin lived. But his death at the start of 1924, following a long illness, opened up a protracted and bitter power struggle. The winner, though this only gradually became obvious, turned out to be Joseph Stalin. Under his leadership, a new and even more terrible phase in the early history of the Soviet Union was to follow. Despite the paranoid fears on the European right, Bolshevism soon proved to be non-exportable. The Soviet leaders had at first reckoned with the spread of revolution across Europe, but during the Civil War, they had to accept that this wasn't going to happen. Lenin realized this no later than the autumn of 1920, when the Red Army was defeated by the Poles outside Warsaw. Conditions in Russia were completely unlike those in the rest of Europe. The very vastness of the country, the largest on Earth, far greater in size than the rest of Europe put together, stretching 5,000 miles from east to west and 2,000 miles from north to south, imposed its own peculiarities of political control. Uniquely, in pre-war Europe, Tsarist rule had been unconstrained until 1906 by any constitutional restrictions, and thereafter only by fig leaf constitutionalism. Russia had no independent basis of law, and no representative framework for pluralistic politics that could have worked for the gradual reform of state institutions elsewhere. Compared with other parts of Europe, civil society in Russia was weak. Only a small property-owning middle class had emerged, and repression of political dissidents had produced an intelligentsia that was tiny but radicalized. Despite rapid modernization that had created an impoverished proletariat in the big industrial cities, Russia had remained intensely backward economically, a country in which the peasantry, more than 80% of the population, lived largely in communes, often in the economic bonds of servility under the neo-feudal dominance of those who possessed the land, and they viewed the state and its officials with great hostility. Violence, brutality, and scant regard for human life had been deeply embedded in this society. The Russian peasantry, as Lenin rightly adjudged, were a revolutionary class with no stake in property and order. Nowhere else in Europe was this true, even accounting for peasant antipathy towards estate owners in many parts of the continent and insurgent tendencies among agricultural labourers in some regions of Spain and Italy. Russia offered socially, economically, ideologically, and politically propitious preconditions, even before the calamities of the First World War radicalized conditions and swept away Tsarism, for a fundamental revolutionary transformation that couldn't be replicated elsewhere. Following the Civil War, Soviet Russia became, in effect, an alien body, as good as quarantined from the mainstream of European politics, turned in on itself and subjected to the immense internal brutality that would accompany the building of the Soviet state and the modernization of its economy over the following years. as a million or so fleeing émigrés, many of them former supporters of the Tsarist regime, spread horror stories about Soviet Russia in European capitals, feeding the anti-Bolshevik hysteria as it spread across the continent. Bolshevism swiftly turned into a bogeyman to be feared and reviled, a negative focus for the politics of the conservative and radical right. During the deliberations of the leaders of the victorious powers, meeting in Paris in 1919 at the Versailles Conference to redraw the map of Europe, Russia already figured only as a negative entity. Militarily supporting the attempt to destroy Bolshevism and not prepared to recognize the Soviet Union, they had no option but to leave the thorny question of the validity and contours of Europe's eastern borders open. The Great Carve-Up. The new map of Europe, when it took shape, looked very different to that of 1914. Four empires, the Russian, Ottoman, Austro-Hungarian and German, had vanished, though the new republic in Germany retained the name Reich, the symbol of a historic German empire in Europe stretching back to Charlemagne. Their collapse amounted to a cataclysmic shift in the political structures of Central, Eastern and Southern Europe. 10 new nation-states, including by 1923 Turkey, emerged in their wake. The task of creating Europe's new order fell essentially on the four leaders of the victorious powers: the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, the French Premier, Georges Clemenceau, the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, and the Italian Prime Minister, Vittorio Orlando. The challenge facing them when they arrived in Paris to begin work in January 1919 was unenviable. Driven by Wilson's idealism, behind which lay the calculated aim of global economic dominance by the USA and a post-war world built in the American image, they had lofty ambitions. One was to set up a framework that would prevent Europe from again descending into war by establishing a League of Nations to guarantee collective security and international peace. It was a noble ideal. After its foundation in January 1920, the League, comprising 48 member states by the end of that year with its headquarters in Geneva, sought to work for international cooperation, to protect ethnic minorities, and to do everything possible to mitigate the humanitarian crisis in Central and Eastern Europe. But most important of all was the commitment to uphold the post-war international settlement. This would prove a pipe dream. Without military might to intervene, notions of an effective multinational framework of collective security were illusory, and for all that it was intended to be a truly global organization, the League remained, in practice, a largely European affair, dominated especially by the interests of Britain and France. Wilson's political opponents in the USA would ensure that America, which was meant to be the League's key player, wasn't even a member. Wilson's central ideal, which underlay the deliberations in Paris, was self-determination. The term was susceptible to different meanings, and Wilson was content to be vague about its definition, not least since its implications for maintaining power in the colonies were barely palatable to the major imperial powers, Britain and France. For Wilson, self-determination essentially meant government derived from popular sovereignty, the right of a people to have their own state, which would ideally evolve over time, and not result from violent revolution. In the disastrous conditions of post-war Europe, however, self-determination, a revolutionary concept, was a demand for the immediate future, not a long-term aspiration. The Bolsheviks had in fact been the first to use the concept, but their interest in self-determination was purely instrumental. Their support for nationalist movements was extended in order to undermine and destroy the existing multinational empires in Europe, and, more generally, to weaken or overthrow imperialism. However, in Stalin's words, when the right of self-determination conflicts with another, a higher right, the right of the working class that has come to power to consolidate that power, then the right of self-determination can't and must not serve as an obstacle to the working class in exercising its right to dictatorship. As this made abundantly plain, national self-determination in the emerging Soviet Union was to become wholly subordinated to the centralizing power of the Bolshevik state. The vision of self-determination that underpinned the deliberations at the Versailles Conference in 1919, to which the Soviets weren't invited, ran completely counter to the Bolshevik interpretation. It was to be the framework for a world order based on liberal democracy, government by popular consent in a state resting on popular sovereignty. The underlying problem, however, was that precisely in the most unsettled parts of the continent, the claim to popular sovereignty was based on ethnic nationalism, and most of the territories of the fallen empires contained more than one nationality staking a claim to land, resources, and political representation. In the countries of Western Europe, as in the USA, the state had over time shaped the nation. Association with the institutions of the state had gradually formed a national consciousness. But in most of Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe, national consciousness had emerged from the demands of a people defined by ethnicity, language, and culture to establish a state that represented, often exclusively, their interests. How was self-determination to be squared with competing claims to a sovereign nation-state? It was obvious to the Big Four from the outset that the complex ethnic mix of Central and Eastern Europe made national self-determination impossible to achieve. The peacemakers could only do their best and hope that functioning nation-states, in which ethnic differences were superseded by national unity in a multi-ethnic state, would emerge over time. However they adjusted Europe's boundaries, these were bound to include some sizable national minorities, whose rights would be safeguarded, so it was thought, by appeal to the League of Nations. None of the new states, apart from the small rump of German-speaking Austria, was ethnically homogeneous. 3.5 million Hungarians, for instance, ended up living outside Hungary, many in territory handed to Romania, while 3 million Germans found themselves living in Czechoslovakia. When the new lines on the map were finally agreed, they had, in fact, less to do with the self-determination of nationalities than with the feasibility of satisfying some territorial claims at the expense of others, while trying to minimize any likely ensuing tension or hostility. Almost everywhere, there were hotly disputed territories. Claims resting on ethnicity were almost invariably spurious, merely a sometimes transparent cover for territorial ambitions, driven by economic, military, or strategic reasons. Claims and counterclaims between Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia, all wanting some of Macedonia, between Greece and Italy over Albania, between Romania and Hungary, both staking claims to Transylvania, or between Poland and Germany, disputing Silesia, were all made by paying lip service to self-determination. But they were actually no more than attempts at traditional territorial aggrandizement. Some claims could barely even pretend to be about self-determination. These included Italy's demands for the predominantly German-speaking South Tyrol, the almost entirely Slav-populated Dalmatian coast, parts of Asia Minor, settled mainly by Greeks and Turks, and what became a cause célèbre for budding fascists, the small port of Fiume, now Rijeka in Croatia, which had only a partially Italian population. Trying to adjudicate on the complex disputes caused nightmares for the big four in Paris. Some artificiality behind the new state boundaries was inevitable. In a number of cases, Czechoslovakia, the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, renamed Yugoslavia in 1929, and Poland, it was a matter of recognizing existing reality in states created from the fallen empires at the end of the First World War.